The Tom Woods Show, episode 701.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
If you're a homeschooling parent and you're tired of running yourself ragged, then check out the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum. And check it out through my special link where you get three free bonuses totaling $160. My special link, RonPaulHomeschool.com. Hello, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm in Auburn, Alabama for the Mises Institute's Mises University Summer Program, but I've got episodes for you all the same. And today I'm talking to Tom Sakata, who is president of the Bucknell University Class of 2017. He's also president of the College Republicans at Bucknell. And as it happens, he is a staff writer for Breitbart News and the producer and co-host of the Milo Yiannopoulos Show, a podcast. And Tom is he's just an interesting guy to get to know. He's probably just under half my age, I would say, and has maybe gone through something like the transformation I went through when I was the vice president of the College Republicans when I discovered libertarian ideas. And so I thought, well, you know, what the heck? Let's talk to Tom Sakata. Tom, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Well, I'm really glad to talk to you. You are really, you remind me of me a lot. You are president of the College Republicans where?
At Bucknell University.
Oh, boy. You should talk to Michael Malice about Bucknell University. He's one of my favorite podcast guests, and I think if he had the opportunity, he would burn that place to the ground.
Is he a graduate? Is he an alum?
He is, yeah. Yeah, and it basically almost sucked the life out of him. But, yeah, and in fact, Harvey Pekar wrote a graphic novel all about Michael Malice, and it includes the letter that Malice wrote, I don't know if it was to the administration, I don't remember the details, basically saying, look, I don't want a Democrat or any other fascist or communist as my advisor. And if I'm given Professor So-and-so, I'm going to burn this place down. I mean, unbelievable.
How old is he? How recently was he at Bucknell? Is he older?
I think he's 40.
Okay.
Yeah. He's going to listen to me and correct me on all the details. That's all right.
So not much has changed.
Yeah, I guess not. What's your experience been there?
Well, I don't want to go out on a limb and say that it's worse than other small liberal arts schools like Bucknell in terms of political correctness and a lack of intellectual diversity amongst the faculty. But I think it's been the typical experience that you would expect as a conservative libertarian student going into college. Most of my professors are leftists, conservative and libertarian authors. I'm an econ major. Economists, they're not in the curriculum. I mean, in the econ department, if you look through the course descriptions, just in the course descriptions, Karl Marx's name appears 13 times. Hayek's name doesn't appear once. Mises' name doesn't appear once. Friedman, Thomas Sowell, none of that. Those authors, those people don't even appear in the curriculum at all. Those books are never assigned. And I had one professor I'm actually fond of, believe it or not, who I took for macroeconomics, where we learn mostly about Keynes. I said, why don't we read anything by Hayek in this entire curriculum, you know, when you're getting this degree? And he said, Hayek's stupid. You know, don't even read him. Don't even read him outside of class. So that's the kind of, there's a certain anti-intellectual movement amongst these so-called intellectuals. These people are supposed to be encouraging, intellectual inquiry and curiosity and the exploration of all different kinds of diverse ideas. But it's really the opposite.
What's interesting is that a guy like Murray Rothbard, who in his day was the dean of the Austrian School of Economics, he knew mainstream economics backwards and forwards. And you can see that in his book, Man, Economy, and State. His footnotes are overwhelmingly to the mainstream economics literature, and he knew it like the back of his hand. Whereas they don't know anything about what we're saying. So that it's always a caricature, it's always a dumb guy version of what we're saying. And I can tell you that for sure because I have another podcast called Contra Krugman where we refute Paul Krugman every week. And I'll tell you, his understanding of the Austrian school, you'll be shocked to learn, is not really all that informed. So now I point out the thing about the College Republicans, even though I know that's going to anger some of my listeners, just because that was my experience too. I was the vice president of the Harvard College Republicans, and Gosh, you should have heard the speech I gave when I was running. I was running against three other people, and I crushed these poor people because I gave such a great speech. It was so fantastic. And I had a friend who, at that time anyway, he was a little on the heavy side, and he was running for member at large of the Republican Club. And he got up and said, look, there are two requirements for being a member at large. Being a member and being large. I'm both of those. And he won in a landslide. So, I mean, so I'm not saying that it was because of my brilliance that I won. But anyway, it was a lot of fun. And then, you know, as time went on, I was in college during the 1992 election, and I watched Clinton versus Bush. And when Clinton won, I really felt like the world was going to come to an end. But little by little, I just came to the conclusion, surrounded by people who disagreed with me on that campus, that either I was going to be all one thing or all another. I just couldn't be this mushy, middle of the road, well, you know, we need government for this, we need it for that, we can't be extreme, we can't cut spending too much. I just thought, you know, I'm either going to be one thing or I'm going to be another. And little by little, I started moving away from that. And I even got to the point where I said to the president of the Republican Club, I think I want to resign. And she said, "You ain't going nowhere. We, you know, I mean, you're not going to leave me to deal with this group." So I stuck it out. My understanding is you're having a bit of the same experience.
Well, to be fair, I know your listeners are probably, you know, I probably have a target on my back with your listeners.
But
now,
I mean, they're sweethearts, my listeners. They honestly are. I mean, they know
I'm one of them.
I appreciate that. They know my history. So they've been wonderful. And the fact is, a lot of them have the same history.
Well, the thing is, I think it's worth mentioning that, you know what, I think I'm going to step down from College Republicans and join the Young Americans for Liberty, try to get a leadership position there, because, I've established myself as a controversial figure, and I think that's what my goal was. But really, if you want to be a dissident, if you want to be provocative, being a libertarian is a little bit too, people aren't going to have that visceral reaction. If you really want to get in people's face, you know, say you're the president of the College Republicans, people will react. And I think there's more of a reaction there. So I think it served its purpose. I mean, I don't know if you read this. It was a big Breitbart article. But I was very suspiciously removed from my post as class president, as junior class president, with 10 days remaining in the semester because of some weird technicality that nearly half of the student government had also violated, a policy that half the student government had violated. They hand-selected me and another student, totally discretionary. And I think kind of like, you know, I had gotten on their nerves a little bit too much. So they wanted to get back at me a little bit, in the last week of the semester. So I totally felt it. I felt, you know, the repercussions of trying to be provocative and it was worth it. But, it, you know, I felt it.
And by the way, being provocative is not difficult these days. All you have to do is say things that all of society and all of the world took for granted for thousands of years. You just say them, and this is outrageous and awful, and no one can imagine that anyone would think such a thing. But all you have to do is say things that liberals themselves took for granted, what, 30 years ago, 40 years ago? I mean, saying almost anything can provoke outrage. All right, so now what's moving you in the direction you're moving in? What's propelling you along that trajectory?
I'll be completely honest. This is not like, you know, I'm not pushing the Tom Woods show, but the Tom Woods show and Real Dissent, those have been two of the big things that have pushed me in this direction. When I take the drive back and forth between my home in South Jersey and Bucknell, it's the Tom Woods show gets me from one place to the other. I listen to a couple episodes and I'm there. And I probably learned more about libertarianism from the show than anything else. And I realized this is much closer to where my true ideological home is than anything else. So I thank you for that. I give you the opportunity to thank you for that on your show, which is incredible.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you very much. I'm glad it's doing some good.
And because of that, I've brought some of the more liberty-minded things over to Breitbart, which has a more conservative bent, but. You know, my colleagues are wonderful, and we don't agree on everything. But, you know, I think that's the beauty of Breitbart, and the beauty of alternative media is that people can disagree, and it's not a big, you know, it's not a big deal.
All right. Well, speaking of Breitbart, now let's bring up the elephant in the room, if we may, here. The whole situation with Milo Yiannopoulos. Now, as this airs, I guess probably this is going to be July 25th that people are going to be hearing this. It's been about a week or so since Milo was booted off Twitter. And I, you know, there's a part of me that thinks that some people will think, oh, this is a trivial matter, so a person is booted off Twitter. I don't think it's a trivial matter. I think it's a bellwether, and I think it's significant. I don't think they chose him at random. And I looked at the tweets that he wrote. I didn't see anything wrong with them. Now people say, well, other tweets by people who follow him were bad. Okay, so punish those people. What in the world could I possibly be missing? Can you tell us what the precipitating factor was that led to his removal from Twitter? And at that time, how many Twitter followers did he have?
Okay, so he had about 338,000 followers at the time of his permanent suspension. And I think the reason why this happened, and it doesn't mean I'm agreeing with it, is that Twitter has had it out for him for a while. He's been temporarily suspended many times. And if you go through the Breitbart history in the tech section, you'll see we've covered it every time he's been suspended for an assortment of reasons. But here, and if you start to read some of the articles that popped up surrounding the story, he's being very closely linked to the actions, you know, of others. Because they believe that he incited some of this horrible, horrible racist abuse towards Leslie Jones from Ghostbusters. He wrote this piece. I mean, the problem is that the Ghostbusters movie, he wrote a piece and said, you know what? This movie is a beloved movie with a male cast, and they're making this movie just to prove that women can do anything that men can do. Obviously, I generally agree with that statement, but to make a political statement with a movie, with a beloved franchise, it's gonna bother some people. So he wrote this story and directed some attention to this actress and is getting blamed for some of the actual horrible stuff she's receiving, even though there's really no reason to believe that he specifically incited it.
So he's gone. Now, there is the hashtag Free Milo that's up and around, but you know, although he can bring a lot of pressure to bear, seems to me the fact is he needs Twitter more than Twitter needs him. What am I missing about that?
I don't think that's true. He's got his Facebook. He's got the podcast that I co-host and produce with him. He's got so many other outlets. He was on CNBC the other day. He's going to find a way to get himself to have himself heard. He's got his Breitbart columns. He'll do live video on Facebook if it comes to it. I think this is going to be another one of those instances of, you know, when you try to shut somebody up, they only get louder, and his audience is going to grow.
It's just that the format of the quick, punchy drive-by smash is so suited to his style and to the Twitter format.
Yeah, well, you know, the interesting thing is that I think this was back in February. He was in the White House press room, and he was going back and forth with Josh Earnest about the fact that Twitter had removed his blue verification check. And Josh Earnest said that President Obama would agree that the success of these social media companies is predicated on their ability to allow a diverse range of opinions and all different kinds of ideologies. And it seems like this move to ban Milo, especially given if you really look at the tweets he sent personally, would violate Obama's prediction. I think this is a bad. If you're an investor for Twitter, this is a bad sign. I think so. I don't know. What do you think about this?
Well, I could imagine people being upset and really liking him a lot, but I can't imagine a lot of people quitting Twitter because it gives them too much. They get too much out of it. It's too much of a benefit for them. I mean, they love Milo, but they like their own well-being too. So I just don't think even a guy as outsized as he is, I don't think he can bring enough pressure to bear against him. I want him to. I would like to see them brought to their knees. And by the way, let me clarify. Every time I talk about something like this, I get somebody saying, Twitter is using its own private property and it can make its own rules. I know. You think the host of the Tom Woods Show doesn't know? Obviously. I mean, do I have to put that as a caveat every single time I talk about the behavior of a private institution? Just because you're a libertarian doesn't mean you can't criticize what a private institution does, even while recognizing they're fully within their rights to do it. It's like some libertarians have accepted the leftist caricature of libertarians, which is that we automatically approve of everything any private institution does. No, you're still allowed to be a person. And so it's perfectly fine to be critical of Twitter, especially when there does seem to be a totally one-sided pattern in the way they enforce the types of behavior they want to see there. It obviously seems to be skewed in one direction. All right. How did you come to be producing this guy's show. And tell me how that podcast is doing, by the way, because it's relatively new. How often does it come out?
Okay, so I had Milo at Bucknell a couple months ago, earlier in this year, early in 2016, at the very beginning of 2016. And he came and he ended up staying for a weekend based on his schedule, and we hung out, we hit it off, and I did a couple pieces for Breitbart, and he knew that I had a radio background. I run the radio station at Bucknell, and he just said, "Hey, let's, you know, I'm doing this podcast, let's do it together." And it's been a lot of fun. We've had Martin Shkreli, the pharmaceutical guy, some really interesting characters. We've had Ann Coulter a couple times, who I'm not the biggest fan of, but she's always, at least at the very least, interesting, you know. But it's always, we had John McAfee on the program, who was probably my favorite guest. He's a little crazy, but I think he's a bright guy. But it's been a wild ride. We've done about almost 20 episodes now. And when we debuted at number 13 on iTunes. We were featured on Meet the Press on NBC. And I'm hoping it only gets bigger from here. We do great in the rankings. And I think Milo really enjoys doing the show. I know I do. I can't speak for him. I love it.
I myself get dragged into stuff on I'll stop talking about Twitter in just a minute. I get dragged into these Twitter debates, and people enjoy watching them, but boy, does it suck up my time. But I still feel like sometimes there's something that's just so wrong, you just have to answer it. So I've had I think I've spent 2 days now arguing with somebody about civil rights or some kind of thing like that. But anyway, before that, the whole Milo thing blew up, and I was looking at somebody's Twitter feed, and it was all people giving each other high fives that they got rid of him. And then the other tweets in this feed were all about, oh, people like Milo are trying to drive us from the internet. Oh, and I thought, but you don't see any irony here at all. So you drove him from Twitter, and you're still on the internet,
right?
And you're whining about being driven from the internet. The only person who was driven was Milo. So can we try to ratchet down the hysteria a little bit? All right. So anyway, it's true, though, that if there were any time in world history that you would be least concerned about being driven from a high-profile platform, it would be right now, because the podcasting world is growing by leaps and bounds, and people are listening to podcasts at an ever-increasing rate, and you have full control over it. You can say what you want, do what you want, distribute it to the whole world. It is it's an astonishing thing. I mean, could you imagine what the world just think about how different the world is from how it was in 1950. I know a lot of times our people say things are getting worse. Oh, things are getting worse than ever. In some ways, they're worse. But in a lot of ways, they're much, much better. The fact that I have my own independent voice and I don't have to worry what three television networks have to say, who would never have given me airtime in the first place, this is a miracle.
Well, I think that speaks to the beauty of Breitbart, because Andrew Breitbart himself kind of proved that if you have a good story, thanks to the internet, if it's a good story, people will listen. It does, and it doesn't matter who you are. You know, I think that's the beautiful thing. And then you talk the same thing about podcasts. We could go on there every day and talk about whatever we want, and it's really incredible.
I don't necessarily agree with Milo all the time, but I love what he represents, which is the guy who just won't be steamrolled by majority opinion. The guy who will say unpopular things, and he'll say them very abrasively, because that's frankly what these people need, which is a splash of cold water in their faces. The guy who basically says, hell no, I won't go, that to me is what he represents. And by the way, I happen to think, I can't get inside his head, of course, but I think what Milo and a lot of others like him see in Donald Trump is less what Donald Trump has said and less what he's likely to do than what they believe him to represent. They believe him to be the same sort of person.
Sure, I think to Milo, and I'm trying to get in. I mean, I know him fairly well. So Donald Trump is a middle finger to the politically correct left and the Republican establishment. You know, Milo has said, he said this on the Dave Rubin show, that he believes that a Trump presidency would blow up the GOP so significantly that the only option would be for it to be replaced by a small government libertarian kind of right wing. I don't even know how viable that is, but that's something that he said. So I think, and he told John McAfee as well. He told John McAfee that he's more politically in line with John McAfee than he is with Trump. So I think he has some libertarian leanings that may start to blossom a little bit more after the I think Trump gets destroyed in November. And I'm interested to see. I'm interested to see if he makes a turn in that direction.
Now, I know Milo's been active for a while, and he only came onto my radar back around the time I had him on my show, which was episode 576. That was some time ago. And then since then, his stock has risen tremendously. He's linked to on Drudge semi-regularly. In fact, the Twitter thing, let me contradict what I said earlier. The Twitter thing has given him tremendous visibility to the point that people who visit Drudge, which that means millions of people, have seen his face, they've seen his name, they're getting to know who he is. How'd this all happen? And how did he start out? Like, what's the whole story behind this guy?
Well, you know, I don't know much about this particular topic because I'm not huge into video games, but he came onto the spotlight originally because of his commentary on Gamergate, which was
a
scandal. But the other thing that Milo is probably the best in the world at is having these discussions about intellectual diversity on campuses. This college tour has brought him into the minds, into the awareness of thousands and thousands of college students, because he'll go there and say, our bodies and our minds belong to ourselves. And because your teachers are being deceptive in the classrooms and limiting the curriculum, they're violating your right to really explore ideas yourself and come to your own conclusions. And that's really speaking to a lot of kids. And I think he's resonating with them in such a way that they become big fans of his very quickly, because he's saying things that nobody else is saying him, and he's saying them in a place where it's really not allowed. So he's been doing some great work on the college campuses this year, and I think that's been a big part of his increased success.
Have you attended any of those events with him?
I hosted one at Bucknell, and then after that, which was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, we went down to Emory. I flew down to Emory University with him in Atlanta, and it was a very hostile atmosphere. A lot of students really didn't want him to be here, as is often the case. And he gave his quick speech. He does about a 15-minute speech, and then he does about an hour of Q&A, because that's really, people want to just ask him questions, whether it's, people who like him or people who don't like him. But most importantly, that was a big issue on that campus, because I don't know if you remember that story. I wrote the story for Breitbart. The kids, were in tears because people were writing, Trump 2016 on the sidewalk. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
At Emory?
Yeah, yeah. These kids are going to have to tough it up, really tough it up a little bit.
And the kids at Emory, that's a really good school. They're really bright kids.
Yeah, yeah.
So we went down there, and what we did after was a beautiful thing. We brought bags and bags of chalk. And after his speech, after his lecture, we went out on campus, and he encouraged everybody to write whatever they wanted. We littered the campus in all different kinds. We turned the entire campus into a free speech wall. And it was incredible. It was just this unbelievable experience. Because that was, for the first time for me, that was what college is supposed to be. Everybody having different opinions. Some people were writing, go Trump. And other people were writing, screw Milo. Like, it was just everything. Anybody was welcome to write anything. It was just incredible. It was incredible.
Yeah, that's a great thing. Now, I have some listeners. I even have some supporters who really couldn't care less about Milo, or they find him obnoxious and they're just not interested. And fair enough. You don't have to be interested in Milo to be a listener of the show, of course. But what you just said accounts for why people like me have a visceral response of support for him, because it is a pushback. I have to think some of these people have not been on a college campus in a long time, to know how stifling it is, and to see somebody who pushes back so hard that what you just described at Bucknell occurred, where all of a sudden, wait a minute, anybody can say anything now. You can be who you want to be, basically. That's an amazing kind of pushback, because normally the narrative is we sit back and take it, and the other side dominates the whole discussion. And if you even manage to get your one mealy-mouthed, pathetic speaker once a year, they're going to make that event miserable for you. These are awful, totalitarian-minded people. They're just awful, with not a single thing to be said in their defense. And to push back as hard as he has pushed back, to the point where these people are basically crying. Well, you know what? Frankly, these people should be crying. All right. I mean, after what they've done to everybody else, that's the least that should happen.
Well, you know what really surprised me is after Milo came to Bucknell specifically, I had a female Republican-minded or libertarian-minded student come up to me and say, you know what? You know, I'm no longer afraid to be myself. And that blew my mind, because you would really think, the way they portray it, you know, you would think, okay, the LGBT kids have to be a little fearful of being themselves. That's really not true. When you think about it, if an LGBT kid says, I want more gender-neutral bathrooms, the university will do it immediately because they're afraid of bad press. If a Republican or libertarian student says, you know what, maybe 90% of our faculty shouldn't be Democrats or they shouldn't be liberals, you know, nobody's going to listen to that. Nobody cares. And you don't want to go into a classroom and say, you know, you're pro-life, or you don't want to say, I'm a hardcore libertarian who reads Murray Rothbard. You don't want to say those things, because people are going to look at you a little differently. You know, it's almost about being transgender on a lot of college campuses is a little bit more normal than being conservative or libertarian. I mean, Caitlyn Jenner just said yesterday it was harder for her to come out as a Republican than it was to come out as transgender.
Yeah. Now, of course, I still have my anger and frustration with the Republican Party, which says, well, you know, maybe that, but I understand the point you're making. You know, and another thing, I find that a lot of times the dissenters on campus, by which I mean the conservatives and the libertarians, are so cowed. They don't even realize it, but they're so affected psychologically by the overwhelming opposition they face and the nastiness of that opposition that they find themselves reduced to things like, oh yeah, you're the real racist. And that just never works. Doesn't work with anybody. Or, you know, or even when people are just outrageously anti-Christian or something. Whatever you want to do, you know, go ahead and do. But,
well, you know what? I know you're right. And I think part of the problem is that, you know, I don't know if you know Tommy Lauren from The Blaze. You know, if she tweeted lock her up, which has been the slogan of this RNC, people would go nuts. It's a lot of conservatives, and why I'm moving away from it significantly is it's a lot of bumper sticker style stuff. That's all they work off of. It's the bumper sticker style language. It's, you know, there's not much depth.
There's not much depth is about the least you can say about it.
There's not. And then, you know, when you go and talk to Young Americans for Liberty, some of the more liberty-minded students, there's some really interesting conversations being going on that are much more just behind these surface remarks that the Republicans will make.
Yeah, absolutely. But then also what I was going to say about Christianity is the Christians will come back and say, but you people are anti-Christian bigots. That does not land a blow. Because bigotry is a word that's meant to be used in only one way, namely against you.
Right.
It can't, it does not, you are not landing a blow by taking their language and applying it to them. Even if you think that intellectually you've got a good case, it just doesn't work. You have to instead just be fearless. Just stand right up to them, let their words bounce off you and fight. Just fight back. Don't turn into some lily-livered, pathetic pile of nothingness. Stand up for yourself.
So I write a lot of stories about, especially the Ivy League schools now, because that seems to be where things are the most radical in terms of progressivism. Was it as bad when you were there as it is now?
No. It's definitely worse now. But you should remember that, you know, even though we did see at Yale that big thing over Halloween costumes, and so, I mean, obviously things must be fantastic at Yale if the only thing they can think to complain about is Halloween costumes. Obviously, things are better than ever from their point of view. Over at Harvard, they had a tradition of each one of the upper-class dormitories is called a house, and there's a house master who's a faculty member who lives there and is sort of the figurehead of the house, and he's referred to as the house master, from magister, Latin for, you know, teacher. And that's now being taken away because master kind of sounds like the master-slave relationship.
Oh, I heard about that. Oh my God!
Are you kidding me? And I had Jonathan Haidt on, who's normally pretty level-headed.
I love him.
And he said that was a change he could live with. And I thought, no. You are giving away way too much. Teach these kids, give these kids a remedial Latin course instead of obliging them in taking that away. What you need to remember about the Ivy League is that, although you will find plenty of campus leftism, bear in mind that these are kids who, in not always, but a lot of cases, come from well-to-do families and who expect to take their place within the establishment. And extremely radical leftism although it's getting more of a spot in the establishment, really doesn't sell there. They want to be radical enough to feel like they're doing something, but they want to be establishment enough to take their what they consider to be their rightful place at the helm of American society. So they're going to – I would tend to think that on the Ivy League campuses, they're going to be a little bit more muted because they do have this establishment bias and, you know, acting in this way that we associate with the social justice warrior left – doesn't get them what they're looking for, either in business or in politics. So it's actually, I think, somewhat milder on the college campus. But by the time I got to Columbia, Columbia is a much smaller university in terms of the undergraduate population, maybe one-fourth as large. There were no like-minded student organizations there at all. There was a college Republican club that was just awful, just terrible, accomplished nothing, and was just embarrassing. But there really wasn't anything. And I thought, well, it's just as well. I'm too busy with doing my doctoral work. But it was a very, very lonely place to be. But now I think it's not just that it's lonely. It's that it's lonely and you feel like you're trapped in your own mind, that if you reveal things that you believe, that you would be seriously ostracized now. It's given how closed people's minds are. And the funny thing is, the people whose minds are so closed are the ones who spend all their time talking about how closed the minds of you and me are.
Well, I know, and you'll never even believe, I think this is worth mentioning too. I know one of the deans at Bucknell, I won't name, and I may be even giving away too much right now, has said that it exists among the faculty too. He's a libertarian minded individual, and when he goes to faculty meetings, he says he has to sit on the other side of the room because people give him looks. You know, people don't want to talk to him because they know that he doesn't toe the progressive line. You know, and I just think that's horrifying. It's a university; it should be the exact opposite of that.
Well, that dean story reminded me of our own dean story. I'm sure he's long gone now. He might even be deceased. Dean Jewett at Harvard. I'm not even exactly sure what he was the dean of, but Dean Jewett would kiss up and suck up to every left-wing group on campus and then selectively punish all the non-left-wing groups. So we started to publish every year in our alternative student publication a Dean Jewett suck-up chart that you could print out and you could put, you know, you could check off when each group is sucked up to over the course of the year. Oh, those fun times.
You know, I'm a senior this year. I'm going to miss it. I think it's not ideal, but it's fun. You know, it can be fun.
Yeah, I know. I had fun too. I mean, I didn't feel like I was being terrorized by anybody. I just felt like I was being given the opportunity to have some fun, cause some trouble in a way that was harmless.
I think that's the important thing is, you know, people will say to me, oh, well, you know, how could you, you know, there's a real minorities that are oppressed. There's real social minorities that have real, you know, oppression. And it's like, well, I'm not saying I'm oppressed. I think all of these conservative and libertarian students are going to be make great successes in their lifetimes. This is more so customer feedback, you know, kids and their, you know, students and their families are making great sacrifices to be there. And universities are not providing the service that they're claiming to provide, this, you know, intellectually diverse experience that they claim they're going to provide, you know. So I think it's a customer feedback thing more than anything else.
If people want to follow you or see what you're up to, is Twitter the best place? I said I wasn't going to mention Twitter, but I don't think you have a website. So what do people do?
You can. I'm at tsiccotta on Twitter, CICCOTTA, and email tom@cicada.com or tsiccotta@breitbart.com, either of those. And hopefully maybe, I know you always do this stuff, maybe you can link to that in the show notes page. I don't know if that's against protocol or not.
No. I'll link to Twitter and certainly to your Breitbart archive so people can check out what you're doing. So this will be all at tomwoods.com/701. And look, tell Milo he's got to come back on the show. He thinks he's too big for the Tom Woods show. Come on, get back here.
I'm sure he doesn't think that. And I'd love to have you out to Bucknell this year if you'd be willing to make the trip.
Oh, that'd be funny. I could bring Michael Malice, but I'd have to keep him confined somewhere to make sure he's not tempted to
you should
cause
bring
any damage.
Both of you guys. No, and you know who else went to Bucknell? Fox Day, who you had on the program a couple days ago.
That's right. Yeah, I'm having him on again in the coming days. How about that? I hadn't realized
We'll have all three of you.
Oh, jeez. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. And yet all three of us combined won't cause the stir that one Milo would cause. So anyway.
Well, probably not. But
well, I appreciate the time and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me on, Tom.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to tell you about tomorrow. Tomorrow you're going to really need to listen to as well. I've got to listen all the time, right? Think of what you might be missing. But before I do that, I want to tell you about another site created by a Tom Woods Show listener, bumblingbees.net. And, okay, why would it be called that? Well, of course, a bee, black and yellow, those are the anarcho-capitalist colors, so bumblingbees.net. And it's a libertarian site, and it's going to give you a lot of interesting commentary and news. But I'll tell you, this one, I actually really, really enjoyed reading, not just for the pure content, but also for the writing style. I actually found myself laughing and smiling through the whole thing. I love the feature Last Week in Weird, which is not difficult to write given the state of society these days, but it'll give you current events, it'll give you history, it'll give you what's going on in the different political parties. I really like it a lot, and so I urge you to check out this site created by a fellow listener, bumblingbees.net, and I will link to it as the listener website mentioned at tomwoods.com/701. Now remember, up until you got a couple-ish weeks, week and a half, something like that, until I yank away one of the bonuses, if you would like to get publicity for a blog you have not yet started, make sure you get your hosting through my link, and I'll give you a shout-out, a backlink. I'll give you 24 free video tutorials, and for a very limited time, a 35-minute screencast video showing you monetization ideas come from my own experience. So how do you do all that? Check it out at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, so what's coming up tomorrow? The 28 pages. We talked about those 28 intelligence pages relating to 9/11 and potentially Saudi Arabia. Well, they were in fact declassified, and everybody was told, oh, there's nothing to see here. This is all just a rehash. There's nothing new in here. Well, that's not so, and I've got a guest tomorrow who's going to tell you that that's not so, and we're going to talk about the real meaning of those 28 pages. So make sure and tune in. Thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.